Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International. And to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting are Caroline White, Deputy Editor, and Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director, who also conducted this week's interview.
I did. This week I spoke to a lovely lady called Hayat Mokanash, and she is a specialist ice pilot. She was fascinating to talk to, so I hope you'll give it a listen. And at the beginning of the interview, there's a bit of chat about Greenland and the difficulties of navigation and how tourism in the area has changed. But then she really gets into the nitty gritty of the ice stuff, which I just thought was so interesting. And the thing that's really stuck with me is that she said she's now so attuned that she can hear ice, you know, without even knowing it's coming. And not only can she hear it, she can even differentiate the different size of it by the sound of the bubbles popping. So she said sometimes she's below deck and people are saying, oh, you've got to come up, you know, there's ice ahead. And she's already been listening to it for some time and can tell, oh, you know, that's something to be worried about or that's not. Which I thought was just amazing. But she also has a really ingenious use for ski goggles as well. So if you want to hear all about that, you'll have to listen to the full interview to find out.
Thank you, Charlotte. That sounds fascinating. I've spoken to a few owners who have taken their boats around Greenland, Northwest Passage and places like that. And an ice pilot is absolutely crucial because before you know it, ice can close in on you and you can be in a lot of trouble very, very quickly. So important to have the right skills and knowledge on board. Talking about skills and knowledge, actually, and people leading boats, we've launched a new captain's club. Some of you might have seen that on the website or our social media channels. This is a club for superyacht captains, for active superyacht captains. It's open now to captains of sailing yachts over 30 meters in length and motor yachts over 40 meters in length. If you'd like to hear more about joining, you can get in touch via the email, which is captainsclub@boatinternationalmedia.com. Or head to the website where you can read the story and there's a few links to get in touch there. But this is a really great initiative. We're incredibly excited about it and we're hoping to have the very first Captain's Club get together at the Monaco Yacht Show in 2021. So there you go. If you're a captain, get in touch. It should be a really active, engaged group. Fingers crossed. And I just wanted to mention a few other things too before we get started. So we were talking last week about boat restorations. And I totally forgot about two of my favorites, albeit these aren't boats that have been restored. These are boats begging for restoration. And I asked the digital team to republish my particular favorite, which is about a boat called Caritas, which is this beautiful 1925 boat that was built for sugar magnate J. Percy Bartram. And it was built in Germany by Krupp. And he owned it for years. And Sir Thomas Lipton was even said to have watched the America's Cup, watched his boat Shamrock race in the America's Cup from her decks. The boat was, of course, requisitioned by the Navy in the Second World War by the US Navy. And she served on in convoys in the Pacific and had a few near misses, including almost being sunk by a fellow US Navy warship, which mistook her for a Japanese boat. Anyway, so after the war, she kind of fell into disrepair and kind of passed through a few people's hands. But eventually she was wound up in a township almost called Smith River in Northern California. And she was dragged onto shore by a couple of entrepreneurs. And she's basically been serving the last 40 or 50 years as a land-based gift shop and a museum. And including, they even got some of, so they found some, these entrepreneurs found some pirate waxworks from Madame Tussauds. And they were hauled into the ship as well. And it was just a kind of real odds and ends kind of museum. It was bizarre. But that's now empty because the local tribe there took ownership of the boat and the property. So now this is kind of what do you do with the boat? But if you can see it on Google Earth. Anyway, this boat is begging for restoration.
Hearing, you know, talking about all these, it's making me think I would love to see like a sort of grand designs of people rescuing boats and doing them up. You know, we quite often get we hear about the ones that need rescuing and then we years later get the kind of big reveal of whatever's been done. But I would love to be a fly on the wall and actually see these things unfold and be there when the owners are getting the bill and when they're finding concrete in the hull and all this other stuff. I think it would make for fascinating viewing.
Yeah. Maybe we should get into that. Well, I think we did think about sending Ed down to Northern California to do some video of the boat, but we can't remember quite. It was a while ago. I can't remember why we didn't do it. But what a history. And for this boat, this historic boat, to wind up basically sitting as a free museum and gift shop in a trailer park in this tiny little town in Northern California. Amazing. So if you're in the market for a in the market for a project, get in touch. The other one I just want to mention is this sailing yacht, this Benetti sailing boat called Blue Gold, which was in a cyclone in 2015 and was kind of blown onto this reef of an island called Moso Island in Vanuatu. And it's still sitting there. It's just sitting there up on this reef, just waiting for someone to salvage her. It's in a bit of a legal limbo at the moment. And it's not an easy task, apparently. We spoke to some experts about dragging it off the reef, which is a hell of an undertaking. But we'll put the story. We wrote a story about that a few years ago too. So again, I've asked the team to dig that story out and put that on the website because it is a brilliant tale. And we'll put links to Google Maps in the description to the podcast, so you can actually see on Google Earth these two boats in these very, very strange locations. Anyway, two boats, two great restoration projects. Check them out.
Well, if you are thinking of taking on a big restoration project, there's another feature that you might want to have a read first to do with submarines, in case you want to get up and have a closer look at your future purchase. That's coming out in our next issue. And I found it fascinating. Caroline actually wrote the piece. And I tend to think of submarines as the domain of sort of filmmakers or really serious five deeps type explorers. But of course, they're becoming more and more accessible for any owner who wants to get up close and personal to what's beneath the waves. And they are just incredible, the latest ones coming out. I thought I'd spotlight a couple of them that just struck me as particularly amazing. One was the new 13,002. And maybe Caroline, you can explain how the wings of this one work, because that's the cool thing about this.
Yeah, so this particular sub came about because Triton had a chat with their acrylic manufacturer who make the sort of acrylic spheres that they put in their submarines. And they worked out that they could actually build a two-man sub that could dive to 4,000 metres, which means that you could get to the Titanic. The problem is that when you get all the way down there, it's really dark. So normally you would have one sub to light the subject and one sub to film the subject, because most people who are doing that sort of a trip want to take some footage. And the reason that you'd have two subs is because filming and lighting from the same angle don't make for very good footage. So the benefit of this sub is that it's got these two, as Charlotte said, kind of gull wings that fold out automatically. And you can film from one tip of that and light from the other tip. So you've got different angles coming from the filming and the lighting, which means that you only need one sub. You can even film back into the acrylic pod and film a presenter, for example, within the submarine.
That's amazing. So these acrylic spheres are so clear. I've actually seen a photo of, I think I've seen a photo of this particular acrylic sphere. It's so thick, but apparently they're so transparent. It doesn't deflect or upset the view outside the bubble at all. But can you imagine that in an acrylic sphere going down to the Titanic? That would be amazing.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things, because there's been this huge increase in popularity in explorer yachts, demand for this sort of submarine has increased enormously as well, because people want serious submarines that can do serious filming. So there's a real market for this kind of submarine.
Absolutely. And the other one that I thought sounded incredibly cool was the 669, which has this quite novel elongated lozenge type shape. And it seats nine people in a theatre style arrangement, but it can also be rearranged and reconfigured for all sorts of different activities, depending on how you want to use it. So there's a cocktail mode, which sounded pretty amazing. So you can have a mixologist on board and do your sundowners underwater. And there's a dining mode, there's a poker mode, which I just thought sounded incredibly James Bond. And you know, playing poker at the bottom of the sea sounded just bonkers, but also kind of amazing. And you can even have all the seating replaced with a massage table, so the sub becomes a sort of underwater pod spa. So really amazing different ways of using things. Personally, I'd be excited enough just to be there looking out at whatever there is, but yeah, to have a drink or a massage at the same time, I guess wouldn't be bad.
So I was talking to Craig from Triton as well the other day about some of these new subs, and so they sound amazing, but none of them have a head on them. So I said, well, you can be down there for 12 hours. And he says, yeah, well, that's 12 hours kind of autonomy. And actually in the fail safe is you can be days under the redundancy built into these subs is such that if something goes wrong, of course, which it won't, you've got days before your life support runs out effectively. So plenty of time to be rescued. But There's no toilets on any of these submarines. So really, the length of the dive is dictated by...
So just the one drink then.
yeah,
exactly. So you can go down with a mixologist and have a bunch of drinks and then, like, oh, we better go up now.
I guess you don't want to be the person that says, guys, how does everyone fancy leaving the whales and returning to the mothership?
Yeah. I think the thing that was most interesting about talking to these guys was, heads aside, they said that when you build subs, when you first start building them as a company, the first 100 or so that you design and build, you're really just making sure that they're seaworthy and they do the basics. You want to get people down and up safely and for them to operate properly while they're down underwater. But now they've got to the stage that they've got that down pat. So they really don't need to think about that anymore. And now they're able to look at these Bond-esque, fantastical experiences that they can create under the water. And I think there are only going to be more and more of these incredible contraptions for having incredible experiences under the water.
I love the quote that the piece ended on as well. The guy from Triton sort of said, owning a yacht without a sub is a bit like flying on a private jet over New York, but never going down and seeing things at street level. And that's made me think about them in a different way, because it is kind of crazy if you're going to these amazing places, maybe you see a bit snorkeling or a bit diving, but you do really want to have a proper look around and you need a proper sub to do that.
Yeah, yeah, you do. And yeah, the market for these kind of subs is only growing, and we know there are more explorer yachts in build than ever before, and many of them are packing these subs, sometimes more than one. So, yeah, it's a good place to be if you're a sub manufacturer at the moment, and Triton do it very well. But there are some other companies like U-Boat Works and Sea Imagine also addressing this market. All righty, Caroline, take us through the news.
Thanks, Stu. So some sad news to start off with. Joe Vittoria, the former owner of M5, has died at the age of 85. Speaking about Vittoria, former M5 captain Rocco Romke said he was a leading light in large sailing yachts, pushing boundaries, always in design and practicality. He added that the big thing about him is that you won't find anyone in the world who knew him that'll have a bad word to say about him. He was a true gentleman in every way. I worked on all his yachts for many years and it was a real privilege and honour. So he will be sadly missed.
Indeed, real legend. And M5, of course, not, you know, he built still the biggest sloop in the world, still the biggest single-masted sailing boat in the world. And back when it was built, you know, completely pioneering. So we've got to really celebrate these owners who take these massive, well, not risks. Obviously, it was incredibly well calculated by Mr. Holland, the designer of the boat, but still, you know, a true groundbreaking yacht. So, yeah, very sad to hear about the passing of Joe Vittoria.
Absolutely. So in case you hadn't heard, this year's Boot Dusseldorf has been cancelled due to the ongoing pandemic. It had already been moved from its traditional dates at the start of the year to April, and the next edition will now take place from January 22nd to 30th in 2022, so get that in your diary. In other news, the first Sunseeker 27.5 metre 90 ocean model has begun her sea trials off the coast of Poole in the UK. It comes after the yacht left the shed in November last year in preparation to launch. The boat features an open plan interior and has a 6x4 metre beach club, not bad for a boat of that size, which will feature an inbuilt barbecue, rain shower, and these adjustable integrated sunbeds that Sunseeker call Extend. They basically flip around electrically so they can face forward or aft.
It's interesting, the after this Sunseeker, because like the 40 metre Benetti Oasis, they're kind of moving away from the enclosed beach club concept, and we're seeing this more and more. And now there's this kind of almost a what would you call it? It's kind of this tumble home down. Yeah. Terrace, that's right, terrace down to the water. So it's completely open stern. And I think we're going to see more and more of these, more and more of these sterns on boats in the future. So instead of that kind of... yeah, the shell door or the transom lifts up and you kind of access this interior space. Designers are more and more just opening that whole area to the sea.
You can see why it's extremely enticing when you see boats like that, particularly.
Yeah, I agree.
And then I thought this was an interesting one, particularly since we were speaking the other week about delayed projects. Turkish Yard Dunya is going to complete the build of the 55-metre explorer yacht Ulukatan, which first began 10 years ago at Newcastle Marine in Florida. The original project was put on hold after the yard ran into financial difficulties. The yacht was transported to Genoa in late 2017, but failed to find a yard to complete construction. So it was then towed to Tunisia and first inspected by Dunya in 2019. Dunya found that while she looked a bit of a mess from the outside, inside it was clear that she'd been built to a good standard with premium brands used for all the main equipment, much of which had been very well preserved. So they then agreed to work with the owner's team to finish the project. Designed by Frypack, the yacht is described as a classically styled rugged explorer yacht with an expected range of 6,000 nautical miles. And when complete, the yacht will boast a 1,200 GT beach club themed interior. So that's all quite exciting to look forward to.
Yeah, big boat, this one. Big volume, proper explorer looking boat. I like it. So it's just nice that it's just happy to see this project that was kind of sitting on the shelves for so long finally being finished. And Dunya, I'm sure, will do a very good job of it.
Exactly. Happy ending.
Yeah.
Actually, I've got a bit of heartwarming, if a bit offbeat news to chip in this week. It's good news if you consider yourself a kind of old-fashioned salty sea dog type sailor, because sea shanties are having a revival, believe it or not. It started on TikTok when a 26-year-old British postman called Nathan Evans did a cover of Soon May the Wellerman Come. If you're up on your shanties, you'll know that that originated in Australia and New Zealand in the 1830s and tells the tale of a whaling crew looking forward to their leave as they head out to make a catch. Anyway, the song went viral. It's so successful. He's now quit his day job and signed a big contract with Polydor and his band. And the single is rapidly climbing the UK charts. In fact, it's currently the most downloaded song of the week so far in the UK. And it is quite good, I have to say. You can see why it's quite catchy. And people all around the world, in fact, have been chipping in with their own versions of the songs, their own shanties. So if you know a good tune, maybe now's the time to gather together your crew and give it a bash yourself.
So a couple of years ago for my dad's 80th birthday, I hired a troupe of sea shanty men, and it was the most fun. Everybody loved them, every age group, everybody could sing along. You don't really even need to know the words to sing along. I really, really recommend getting some.
Who had that on their 2021 bingo card? Sea shanties making a revival.
I can see why they are, though, because they are quite cheering. Caroline's right, they're quite rousing. And the particular song that's doing so well, I only listened to it for the first time this morning, actually. I think I saw it on an advert earlier this week. And it really sticks in your head as one of those earworm type things that you just goes over and over again. And I don't know, if they can cheer up the dark nights on the ships in the middle of nowhere, maybe they can see us through the rest of lockdown.
Maybe that's why they're popular. They kind of tap into that.
I think so. There's a kind of positive energy to them that's, Anyway, that's my news.
What's next? But barbershop, is that going to come back as well?
I hope not. I'm less a fan of the barbershop quartet.
From sea shanties to active shipyards. Caroline, I'm going to leave you to try and figure out that segue.
Thanks. That was a seamless link, Stu. I can see you're a real pro. So this week, we thought we would take a much closer look at data around shipyards themselves and how that sector is changing and has changed in the last couple of years. In our latest global order book of super yachts in build or on order around the world, we recorded 179 active shipyards, which are between them building 821 boats. That's more projects and more yards than a year previously. The latest figures mean that yards have an average of 4.6 projects in build each. It's the biggest number of active shipyards since 2014, and that year, 86 fewer yachts were in production within those yards, so it seems like a pretty good result. To put that into a longer timeline, we had about 200 active shipyards before the 2008 financial crisis. We then saw a decrease between 2009 and 2015, and the level was maintained at approximately 155 shipyards between 2016 and 2019, so it kind of leveled off. Since 2019, the number of active shipyards has risen again and was continuing to rise, but with the impact of COVID, our data expert Raphael Montagnier thinks that from next year, we can imagine the number to stabilize again at 180 active shipyards. Unsurprisingly, Italy is ranked number one, because it's always ranked number one in our stats, in terms of active shipyards, with 52 active shipyards. That's up from 48 the previous year, and again, the highest number of Italian yards working since 2014. There are also more yachts in build in those yards than in 2014. The latest average is 7.8, while in 2014, the average was 5.3. So moving away from averages, it's interesting to see that of the 179 active yards in the Global Order Book, 87 are building only one project. That's up 10% from last year, while 60 have three or more super yachts on their order books. Of those 60, 19 have 10 or more projects underway. That number is also up 10%. So it will be interesting to see how the pandemic affects the pattern of building in the next few years. Will it kill off those smaller yards, or will new yards continue to blossom?
Well, I mean, it's always risky when you're only building one project. So there's 87 yards in that list that only have one project. Okay. And and that's up a little bit on last year.
Yeah.
We're still quite not back at pre-GFC levels. So there was 200 active shipyards before the 2008 financial crisis. We are creeping back there, though, but we're expecting it to stabilize about 180.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, thanks for that, Caroline. A really interesting insight there into active shipyards around the world. And we'll see how they are performing a little later this year when we compile the next global order book, which will be out in the January 2022 issue of Boat International and Boat International US edition. But now, on to Charlotte's interview with ICE pilot Hayat Mokanash.
So I'm joined today by Hayat Mokanash of Arctic Yachts. She's a yacht captain and navigator, but the reason she's here today is because she's a true ice expert. She's been working everywhere from Arctic Norway to Greenland and Iceland, and she's helped many a yacht and their crews navigate particularly tricky passages over the past 10 years. Hayat, hello.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for coming on. Where are you at the moment? I know that you've been out and about on the boat. You've been a tricky one to pin down.
Yeah, I'm based in Iceland, in the west fjord of Iceland, and yeah, very nice, but also weather is also very nasty.
Yeah, well, we've been having similar over in the UK. We've had a bit of snow over here as well. So the first question I had, sort of talking about adventure travel and owners, because that's something that we hear about a lot, is on the up. And we hear that owners are increasingly interested in going to the kind of places that you work in currently. So Iceland, Greenland, that sort of thing. But have you actually seen a notable increase in the number of yachts and the number of super yachts visiting these areas yourself? Because you've been there for over 10 years, haven't you?
That's correct. Yes, and totally. I've seen many boats coming every year up to Iceland, Greenland. I think that people are getting more attracted to this remote place for the exclusivity, you know, like being where nobody else is. I think that's the new trend of feeling the luxury. Like, yeah, it's very nice actually to be in the anchorage where you are the only one and you don't have to see other boats or hear other generators or, you know, all this kind of thing. I think that people are now looking more for this kind of destination, for the peace that it offers.
And how do you feel about that as someone who's lived in the area for a long time? Does that bring problems with it, or is it something you're very glad to see because it means sort of more tourism, in inverted commas, coming to the area?
Well, I think it's nice in a way because, you know, the place is so vast. There is room for everyone. You don't have, like, you can still easily be isolated in an anchorage and not seeing anybody for weeks. Mm-hmm. And as long as, again, we try to keep the spirit of being concerned about the environment. And
yeah,
I think that's the most important thing. I remember, I hope this place will never turn, you know, like a Mediterranean where you have like a huge cloud of pollution over the sea. That's so, but I think people are more concerned now about this and are much more careful about, the pollution and all these kind of things. So, yeah, and I also notice people that come here, no matter, you know, if it's a big yacht, we kind of share this passion for these beautiful places. They approach it generally very carefully and respectfully.
Well, that's good to hear. And talking about the sort of the ice specifically, why do people need an ice captain and an ice expert? Why can't they just get there? I mean, it might sound stupid, but lots of people have very capable captains. Why can't you just have your normal captain do the job for you?
So that can be a long answer, but I'm used to compare this, like, if you want to climb the Mount Everest, you will take an experienced guide to be capable to do this ascension as smooth and safe as possible. You might be a good mountaineer, you might be an experienced mountaineer, still you want to surrender yourself with the experience guides. And mm-hmm. I think high latitude sailing is very similar to, you know, extreme mountaineering. And having an ice expert will allow you to approach the ice much more carefully, find the best path, find the best shelter, and make the smoother progress, and give also people possibility to enjoy it and take the stress away from you. Like, at least the stress is not on mm-hmm. you. When you have no experience, this kind of sailing can turn quickly to a nightmare. So to be on the safe side and being capable to enjoy the beauty of this experience, I will always recommend to have people that has more experience. Of that, if I go to mountain, I will definitely want to have a very experienced guide with me, because that's not my field.
So what sort of things do you kind of look at that maybe other people wouldn't think about? What are the sort of the dangerous areas out there that you can come into difficulties? How do you kind of approach it, basically?
So basically, it takes a lot in the preparation. You, like, many months, weeks before you start your trip, you have to first of all spend a lot of time on your boat and prepare your boat and make sure that you have, like, as much backup as possible, because mm-hmm. you have to consider that you're going in the middle of nowhere, and that's one of the most important things to consider when you prepare this kind of trip. Prepare yourself physically, prepare yourself mentally, prepare your boat, and again, give yourself a chance to be ready for any kind of situation. And then you observe the ice charts, you observe how the ice is evolving, how the weather will have consequences on your navigation, and you adapt. And you adapt your course, you adapt your itinerary, but again, you also have to prepare, like, tons of backup plan. Like, if this don't go, if you are stuck and you cannot, you have to think about, okay, plan B, I will take this route. If this do not work, I will take this route. You have to be capable to know how to approach the ice. Very often, for instance, you have a fog along the coast. Mm-hmm. So the summer season, luckily, we have all day long. We have light, but the fog is like you can barely see the bow of the boat. So the places are badly surveyed. So there are still many rocks that are not on the charts, small islands that are not on the charts. I mean, it's just
really,
yeah, that's the crazy thing. And when you pass with the fog, you have your radar, but the next day is a clear day, and then you realize that, oh man, this was not an iceberg. This was an island. This is crazy. So you take all these notes on your software. You collect data. You collect waypoints year after year. It's allow you to go faster, to go safer, to your destination. But there is so many factors to think about. And you really need to rely on your crew and your boat. That's one of the most important things, and be well prepared. And yeah.
And what sort of difficulties have you heard of boats getting into in the past then? You must hear some horror stories of boats that have come into real difficulties. What sort of things to catch people out, really?
So again, I think that bad preparation is what leads to nightmare. Like, if the boat is not well prepared, the crew will be exhausted. So I experienced a trip from France to Greenland when I was a crew, and the captain was like, yeah, the boat is ready, it's fine, we are just ready to go. And we were short-handed, but after a couple of miles the autopilot gave up. So the guy, okay, let's keep going. Okay, no problem. But when you're short-handed and you start already a season with a boat that is leaking, with no autopilot, lack of sleep, you're cold, you start, you arrive on the spot, bad management of timing as well, is the next day guests are coming on board. So you have no time to rest, you have no time to fix the boat. And this is I think what makes this kind of trip for crew, for guests because they feel that you're tense. You're already at the edge at the beginning of the season. And yeah, to me, that was the most difficult, because there is way, even if maybe people don't always have budget, but there is always a way. You start 6 months earlier. If you don't have people, if you cannot hire people, you start 6 months earlier, make sure that you don't start the season with a boat that you don't trust and with a crew that is already, you know, like leaving at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we went and we finished the last preparation at 4 o'clock in the morning. This is ridiculous. So this is one thing. Then of course there is all the bad weather factors, but this is our job. To me, it's more easy to handle bad weather, being in the ice for hours, than like being angry at someone that, you know, didn't make his job properly and put you in trouble.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the most dangerous areas that you, in your opinion, kind of everywhere you've traveled or everywhere people tell you they want to go, where do people say, oh, we were going to take the boat here, and you think, oh, that's going to be a tough journey, or that I'm not so sure that's a good idea? Where do you view as kind of difficult, challenging, high risk?
So surprisingly, it has its danger, of course, but I'm not saying I'm familiar, but this is my playground for many years, so I feel part of it, and I adapt to it much more easily than a few years ago. I was sailing from Singapore to Philippines, and I found it super dangerous because it was full of driftwood, full of small fishing boats with no navigation lights. There is a risk of piracy. And when the night comes, I mean, your radar is basically useless when there is a, you know, rough sea, and you don't see this big piece of wood, and you are on the plastic boat, and you're just like, as soon as the night comes, it's just like there is a big anxiety, and because you realize that this is lottery. You're sailing at night, you know, and you don't know what are those small boats' intentions. And this is much more, to me, dangerous than sailing in the ice.
Mm, yeah, that's a good point. And going back to kind of preparing the boat, if owners are doing a kind of journey to somewhere where there's a lot of ice, you talked about preparing the boat. What exactly do you mean? Obviously, time is a factor. So making sure you've got enough time and making sure you've got enough crew. But in terms of the boat itself, is it strengthening the boat? Is it having spare parts? Is it having provisions? If you can imagine I'm an owner and you're going to walk me through, here are all the things you need to do. What are the kind of steps that every boat needs to take before they go into areas where ice is a problem?
So yeah, to make sure that your boat is suitable for this kind of navigation, reinforce it if it's necessary. But basically, people that want to go in that kind of area already choose materials that are suitable, like steel, aluminium. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, go through all your technical equipment and be sure that you have even the small screw, you know, that might be, that's the kind of little pieces we don't necessarily think about, but that can be a problem because, yeah, there is no shipyard or very little facilities to fix or repair. So, and always have a basically backup of everything, food enough, because again, we are going in places where there is no Costco every corner, you know, so you have to be capable to be self-sufficient for no matter how long is your trip, and then rely on, okay, for the food, you know that you have that much weeks, that much months. Then once you are on the spot, you know that you can fish, you know what you can find, you study, you have people like me, for instance, that will tell you, okay, this is where, in this place, this is where you can find, so do not worry if you don't have fish or if you don't have meat, we will have this there. And going as much as possible for sea trial, knowing your boat capability, your boat limitation, training, having a training crew. And that's also now when I take a commandment, I will insist on coming on board like months earlier. I want to know the boat in and out. Mm-hmm. But not only me, I also want my crew to know the boat in and out. In case something happened to me, I want the boat to be totally confident for my safety, for our safety. So I will always take the crew like 1 or 2 months earlier to get to know each other, to get to know the boat, and go out and practice. And so you don't have to worry about getting to know each other, the way we work. All of this is already set before departure.
Right. And you also help kind of deliver boats, don't you? Partly you're helping owners who want to do these journeys, you're coming on board with them, but you also sort of help deliver boats through particularly complicated passages and things like that. Can you talk through a few that you've done that might be relevant?
So, yeah, I made a trip in 2011 or 2012, but it was the first trip I made to Greenland on Billy Budd as a delivery crew. And I came earlier on the boat, helped with the technical preparation, and then assist for the watch and being part of it. That was as a delivery crew. And it was when I arrived to Greenland and I knew that was the place I wanted to keep going. Since then, I've been there. And now what I do is I advise people, I guide them, how to navigate, how to get ready. And basically, I will be, my help is more when we reach the ice, actually, like this. So for the offshore sailing, I'm part of it. But once we reach the coast and we approach the ice and the uncharted place, this is where I'm kind of,
So when the ice expert is called in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I enjoy it. This is that's to me this is the most exciting part of the job is this.
And how does the ice vary in different, is the ice navigation you do in Greenland different to what you do in Iceland, different to what you do in Svalbard? Does it differ in kind of size, speed, fog, or is it pretty much you don't know what you're going to get wherever you are?
So we have all this ice chart that helps a lot to plan our trips, to know where, and basically, for instance, if you are in Greenland, there is a lot of glaciers, so you will have a lot of mashed ice when you approach the fjords, and you do not approach this ice the same way than when you are in Baffin and you have much more sea ice. The sea ice is pretty big plate and is drifting very quickly. You can get trapped very easily if you are not careful, if you are not capable to pull out and maybe this course might look the shorter, but in fact it will be safer and will make much more decent speed if we take a detour and go around. So definitely every place has its own particularity. The fjord system, for instance, you will have the same phenomenon of weather, but from one fjord to another fjord, it might be totally different.
And how much do you rely on sort of digital, you talk about radar and things in your everyday work? Is it a very big part of what you do, or do you kind of think actually it's as much to do with your eyes as it is anything else?
So, well, eyes are definitely eyes and your ears. The more time you spend in this area, the more your sense become sharper. And the smell of the ice is funny, but you can smell ice and you might not see it, but you smell it. But definitely one of the instruments that we use mostly is the radar and the depth sonder. Because as I said, the charts are not surveyed, are badly accurate. There is a pretty important offset, GPS offset. So if you just rely on your navigation plotter, you might find yourself ashore. It's one of the things. Basically, what I will do is the radar is one of the instruments we use most, but it also has its limitation. That means that if you are in a fjord that is packed with mashed ice, radar as is totally useless. It will just show a big green screen. Mm-hmm. So then is Ski Google helps a lot when you have a fog.
Ski Google.
Yes, totally, totally. And now the thermal cameras are helping also to find a path of clear water. But then basically so far what we were doing is checking our depth sonder. Depth sonder also is very useful, but there is few little things that is important to keep in mind. For instance, when you are in a place which is very charged with sediment, the depth sonder will freak out. Or you might also have big a score of caplins, for instance, that will pass under your boat and it will freak out your depth sonder. So often when I have a big doubt, it's a new place, I have no idea, we will just basically take the rib, have a hand depth sonder, and the rib will guide us.
Right, okay, so you'll go forward in the rib and then take the boat after.
And yeah, exactly. So I will send someone on the rib and find
some lucky person is given the chance of going ahead to check that that's not deadly.
So yeah, and yeah, very important instruments is the communication instruments, the radio, the sat phones. This is something you also have to learn. But in this kind of climate, the batteries last less. So always take a spare battery, always take a spare radio, and so yeah. But and that's the exciting thing, because you know, like you say, lucky the guy that is in the dinghy, but in fact he somehow there is like, you know, this back in the time, like he is a proper exploration, you know?
Yeah. And are there any other, I think it's so fascinating what you're saying about things like, obviously there are sort of tricks that you've picked up having done this for the best part of a decade, like you can smell the ice and you know not to rely on your sound radar and you know to wear ski goggles to see through the fog. Are there any other little kind of hacks like that that you know that you think most people wouldn't know that you've just picked up after years and years of doing it?
The sound of the ice, for instance, is... you know, it has a big resonance when you are inside the boat, and it's also and it's also one of the things, like when we approach the ice, for instance, I mean, you cannot escape at some point. You will have to approach and to be in contact with the ice, and I think that is what is scary for people that comes first time. You know,
yeah, for sure.
This contact, like, but you know which one you can approach, you which one you can lie on it and push slowly. But inside, it sounds like it sounds terrible. It's awful. Like, and at night, for instance, when I am at the anchorage, I can hear the air bubbles, you know, in the ice that is drifting. So you will hear like click, 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 this kind of sounds.
Yeah.
And according to the frequency and the speed, you can guess how big or how much ice is coming, you know, and that's the little thing. So sometimes people, there is ice coming, and I'm inside on the chart table, and I'm just yeah, I know it's fine. It's, you know, because it's not like you know that this is not dangerous. So you will check, of course, but the sound is super important. All these kind of little things, like you really have to use your senses constantly.
And what kind of things do worry you? What kind of things make you think, okay, we've got to be really careful here because this is, you know, this is serious? What sort of things make you really sit up and pay attention?
So what makes me worry is the fact that it's not charted, and when you have a very poor visibility, you have a narrow passage to take, growler or iceberg has loves to ground, you know, in this shallow water, and is either you take this passage, which is like the place where you are supposed to go, either you go all around and it takes an extra day or something like that, but you've been there in the past, but you have on one side you have an iceberg and on one side you have a rock, or it might be a rock because it's shallow and you guess that you have not much room. So that's the kind of thing, like, okay, I will send the dinghy. I know that in the middle I have room, but I have to go still at a slow speed. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of thing, like, what, you know, if there is a rock that we didn't spot, or it happened to me like a few years ago in Disco Bay. We were in the archipelago in a very beautiful and peaceful anchorage, but archipelago means that it's pretty shallow around, and big iceberg from Ilulissat Glacier comes and ground around this island.
Mm-hmm.
And with the tide, with the sea, they will capsize, they will move, or they will create tsunami. And wow. The next day, the seabed might be different. So a passage that you took a day before or a week before might be different the next time you go through it. So that's what is scary. But again, if you approach things, is to me, this kind of navigation it teaches you, you know, lessons like and value. Like, you cannot take anything for granted. And mm-hmm. it's not because you made it this time that you're going to make it next time. You always have to be extremely careful and always never be like overconfident.
And have you ever been defeated by anything? Have you ever tried to do a journey where you just thought, actually, we're here, but it's too dangerous, we have to turn back?
Turn back now, but many times, yes. Like one of the last trip I did, we were heading to Greenland. And there is a beautiful passage in the south of Greenland that cuts Greenland from east to west or west to east. Is a Christiansen passage, and it's like a jump in a time. It's big wall of mountains, and you have 90 degrees turn, and it's just. But yeah, ice makes it possible or not. So we approached the entrance, and it was absolutely not possible to make it. But we had customers on board, so, you know, everybody, as soon as you approach the shore, everybody has this kind of excitement, they want to yeah. stretch their legs. So you also have to deal with this kind of pressure somehow.
Mm.
But, I mean, you have to find the right words to say, okay, guys, we're not going to be at the anchor tonight. It's going to take like a couple of hours more. And then it's like this couple of hours more turns to be like a day, an extra day, because you have fog, ice, and you are going extremely slowly with the radar, with someone on the bow, someone in the dinghy, and then you see that everybody, the crew gets tired because you just made a crossing, offshore passage, you know, and you need to find a spot to spend the night. But you have no idea, no visibility, like, and you approach like blindly with the radar, and the next day you see this place when it's clear, and you're just like, oh wow, okay, that's what we done. All right.
Yeah. There must be some tense moments when the sun's yeah. coming up. And you think, wow, we were either side of some scary things there.
Exactly. But that's also the thing, you know, and the thing is, we could not get those people ashore. Of course, you know, is the when we arrived, it was foggy, it was evening, and so everybody had to wait until next day. But when you realize that next day there is not much to do, and if we start to stop now, we're gonna take a huge delay on our itinerary. So it's okay, guys, early departure, let's go again, And then in this, but it is also beautiful adventures. These people are still writing to me. We had a beautiful, and at that time not beautiful, was a bit stressful, like some sea ice, a little bit packed in this passage, and we had to wait. And there was an opening, so we managed to go like very quickly, and it was like, I remember the joy on board, you know, like we felt very successful, like, yeah, we made it. And then the next corner, same configuration, except that we had to wait for like 3 hours on standby, you know, on front of, and it was like not so, it was maybe 2 meters wide, but it was impossible to tick to go for our boat. So we just had to wait and be super patient. And this is where, you know, like you start, the psychology starts to take the, you have to manage to keep people patient, because their impatience might push you to take wrong decision.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the challenging part, because you start to be tired, you want to to, of course, give the best to these people, but it's just like, we cannot do otherwise. We just have to wait, you know?
Guess it's like being an astronaut in a way. You have to be super calm all the time and just make logical decisions. It must be hard because when you think about it, you know, boats are constantly coming out. They're faster. They enable you to go for longer ranges. There are helicopters so you can go off and explore. So I think both kind of charterers and owners are conditioned not to have to wait for stuff because lots of people have limited time. They want to get the absolute most out of their time. So it must be difficult when you're faced with people who are not happy about hanging around for 3 hours and there's nothing you can do about it. I can't imagine being on the receiving end of that. It's tough.
And I think that's the thing, like when we are on the commercial boat and we want to share the beauty, and that's what I also enjoy most is, you know, like often people say that there is a before Greenland, for instance, and after Greenland, and they come with all this, you know, these things that they take for granted, like a flight. We have to be like 2 hours before the flight, or we have to catch the flight at this time. But in this kind of place, you just have to adapt and to be super flexible. You know, we will do our very best, but you always have to keep a margin for flexibility because things might not go the way we want. But that's if you want to sail in this kind of place, you have to be capable to accept this information and adapt to it. Otherwise, you will suffer. You will suffer or make, again, bad decision. And I often say to my guests, the first day on the briefing is I'm kind of being firm and explaining them, guys, this is not a place to challenge yourself. You know, if you want to prove something to yourself, I will not encourage you in that direction because your personal challenge might put the rest of the team at danger. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, again, is there are people like search and rescue that, you know, will risk their life for your mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's very important. And that's something I always insist is we sometimes have to be capable to be a chicken, you know, and it's, mm-hmm. and it's fine. It's perfectly fine. Like being alive, actually, this is like if you manage to have a trip where you're alive, the boat didn't break, and you still manage to see beautiful place, you should consider yourself super happy.
Yeah, successful. And let's talk a bit about how you got into this, because you mentioned earlier you kind of came to Greenland once and then just never left. So how did your career start and how has it developed?
So I started in Caribbean and I enjoyed very much. Until I was a bit bored and I always had this big dream. I have this tendency, you know, if I start something, I have to aim to be the best. And since I'm a child, you know, we had all these adventurers and documentary. And it was like, if I'm alive, I want to have a chance to see this place. And basically, just I took my backpack one day and then went to Norway. It was all, you know, accessible. There was already tourism activity, skiing trips from the boat, and so it was pretty easy to find a position there. But then again, something was kind of missing, and Svalbard. I was always attracted to Svalbard, but there was something like, I want to go where there is nobody. You know, mm-hmm. I have seen many places like Norway or Ushuaia where there was already a lot of boats, and I was a bit shocked by the mentality sometimes among sailors. You know, like I decided to become a sailor because it's not only, like, of course, the sea, the love for the nature, but the philosophy, you know, that the sailor has. It's a big family. We all help each other. But unfortunately, when there is a business involved, everybody is very protective. So I was like, Greenland, Canada, you know, there was not so many people at that time. So, and I felt myself, much more complete because there was so little information. You learn so much, and yeah, this is to me much more exciting because of course also the culture that those place has to offer. But the more time I was spending in Greenland or in Canada, I was just like I just wanted more, and I always I'm not a big crier, but when I was leaving Greenland, I was crying. I was like, I don't want to leave this place. It's very demanding, but it brings you so much peace and happiness. Like you really like the thing you see is just like, wow. And all day you are like a child. And even if it's a place that you know, you're just constantly amazed. And this is very addictive, in fact, because you're constantly thinking. Your brain is always like planning, and what do I do if this goes wrong? I have this, and I think that's the thing that makes it super exciting. You, at the end, is when you come back to normal life, you feel like you can go through anything, you know.
You feel invincible, I guess.
You feel like you can adapt to many other situations. And it's funny because with this COVID, for instance, you know, it didn't change much, for instance, my routine, because I was making joke out of it, but I think that we've been in quarantine for, you know, all this time we are in Greenland, we are in quarantine.
And one thing I thought was interesting that you guys are working on is you had mentioned that you're kind of working with some of the local indigenous people that live there and trying to kind of bring them on board the yachts and sort of bring them into the process a bit. And I don't know much about that, but I know from a few travel companies that I've worked with in the past that maybe the early yacht travelers maybe weren't that respectful or that aware of the local customs and the way of doing things, and that sort of got things off onto a bad foot, maybe, in terms of the people there. So what's your view on it? Like, what do people think of yacht owners coming into these areas? Are there any misunderstandings or views about things which you're trying to change and vice versa?
So I think that people are very happy. Like, I had the most, and this is also one of the reasons I fell in love with this kind of place, because the way people are welcoming us was overwhelming, you know. Like, they was, oh my god, you've been sailing the ocean to come to our place, and then they take you and show you the grandfather kayaks and all, you know. They are super open and so glad that you've been sailing Atlantic to come all the way to their place. But then I think it's also the way we approach them. We have to, this is what we are trying to also kind of teach people, is like, hey guys, look, you know, Inuit cultures or indigenous, they are like, you know, like you and me. They have an iPhone, they have all the normal equipments, and it's kind of annoying me sometimes. I had passengers, for instance, that was so surprised that that the young people had the last Nike and was not wearing a polar bear skin, you know. It's just like, this is, if you approach local people this way, of course they get offended. And I remember one of the first time I went there, we had a guy that made a comment to the mayor that was welcoming us, and he said like, oh, your English is very good. And the guy was like, yeah, we have school, we learn English, you know. I think to approach them like a totally normal people and not like, you know, like a salvage or whatever. This is terrible to believe this kind of thing. And people have to understand that, like, you cannot find all kind of facilities that you will find somewhere else. But if you go in Caribbean island, it will be very similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
And it's about, as well, about, we develop tourism activity out of this place because they are very special, very beautiful. But my philosophy is, in life, is I'm not a taker. It has to be a win-win. Mm-hmm. That's very important. So I will always try to get a local guide, because for the good of my customers is better to have someone that has the local knowledge, but on top of that, that will teach you about the culture, and this will make the experience much more different than if you have someone that is not familiar with those regions.
Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to ask you a bit about the Polar Code, because I know that you help yachts kind of need to comply with that, with the paperwork and the different things, and some owners struggle with it. Is it a difficult thing for yacht owners to kind of comply with?
So for the Polar Code, I would say basically is more for the boats that are about 500 gross or a ton, which is the boat I'm used to operate are smaller than that. But basically, if it's a matter of complying with those regulations and make your boat suitable, make sure that your crew has the right qualification, and then is mainly administration. So is mostly time. It takes time. So and that's one of the things in your planning. You have always to consider, like, if it takes 3 months, plan to do that maybe 2 months before, you know. And because in any country, unfortunately, administration is pretty slow. So And without it, you cannot go to Svalbard, for instance, or Antarctica. So it's just being aware of the time that it needs to apply and have everything in place.
And then the last question I wanted to ask you, just because it seems like you have been to so many amazing places, like, I can't imagine what incredible things you've seen. Like, what for you has been the most incredible moment of any journey that you've done? And where would you recommend that people go? If I'm an owner, I've never been to anywhere icy before, but I've got unlimited budget, I want to do a really good trip, where would you say, here's where you should go, it's amazing?
So I think I'm totally in love with the Disco Bay. It's said that it's one of the most touristic, but there's no bad about it. I mean, this place is so beautiful. The icebergs are enormous. The sound of it, the wildlife, like, you have humpback whales, Greenlandic whales. When you arrive there at the summertime, there is a kind of fairy atmosphere. Like, the colors are incredible. The night sailing you don't want to go to sleep. You know, that's the thing. It's just like,
wow.
You feel like a child, and you're afraid that you're gonna miss something if you go to sleep. And the people are so beautiful. Like, the fishermen, the hunters is like, and it's so friendly. Like, it's a very rich experience. Like, so there is a lot of places that I love for their wilderness, like Canada, where you have polar bears and you have walruses. And of course, it's very emotional place, you know, when you sail and you arrive there. So, but If it's first time you're going to high latitude and you really want to see something totally different, and I think Disco Bay is the first place to start.
And the most amazing moment of any trip you've ever been on?
The last trip I did to Baffin, it was a mind blowing trip. Like, you're high in adrenaline and you're high in emotions. As I said, we were sailing from Greenland, and we were going for a recce and a photo tour in Baffin and Lancaster. And from the first day we arrived there, it's just like we've been so lucky with the wildlife. So lucky, and also, I believe, you know, like... It might sound weird, but you've after some time, you're just like an animal in this place, in fact. So the first time when we started to approach the coast, it was early morning. There was it was very flat sea, some ice pack, and And then there was so much action in this quietness, like the wildlife was very active, which it started with a guillemote that was plunging and going out, and like, but in a very stressful way. And I was like, what's going on? He's like, and then at some point he didn't come out anymore. And then you could see a seal behind, you know, and he was like, ooh, early morning, this is like hunting hours, you know, hunting time. And then you start to see a small piece of ice with the fresh blood and birds trying to catch the leftover. And you're just like, oh man, okay. So, and we were supposed to approach a glacier, but there was this little piece of ice that caught my curiosity. And it's just like, it looks very fresh, you know, otherwise the birds will not pick the leftover. So, and not far away, there was a sea ice pack. And it was like, there is like, it's early morning, it's time where they are hunting, something is going on. So you're just like, okay, guys, look, I have this feeling like maybe we will go later to see this glacier. And we've seen also many, and there will be many on the trip. I would like to try to follow this lead. There might be something, you know, because this little piece of ice is too small for the polar bear to sit on it and eat. But he might have caught his prey and find a solid spot to eat his prey. And after a couple of miles, we saw this polar bear eating his seal. And it was like, oh my God, what we are witnessing is just incredible, you know? And then we stopped the boat to not scare him and to be as quiet as possible. And we could observe him. He saw us, he looked at us, and that was like kind of, you know, to have this eyes contact was just, whoa. And then from this started like another one was approaching quietly behind, trying to steal this. And it was mind blowing. We were all high. I mean, the whole day it took like, you know, hours to recover from this. Like, oh my God. And the whole trip was like that. Like we've been studying place about where to see narwhals, but we, you know, you never go with the 100% warranty. That's also the beauty. But when this happens and you follow your leads, you follow your instinct, and you manage to be, yes, surrounded by thousands of belugas, for instance, it's just like, it's one of the best feeling in the world. You feel like so lucky to see this and to be part of it. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you, Hayat. Thank you so much. Obviously, for anyone's listening and wants an ice adventure anytime soon, Hayat can help you through it. Thank you so much and good luck with the rest of your trips.
Thanks to you and take care.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Ed Cavendish and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.